I'm Andy Thompson, Senior Editor of Private Debt Investor, and welcome to the Private Debt Investor podcast. For today's episode, I sat down with Yuri Kroll, Global Head of the Alternative Credit Council within the Alternative Investment Management Association, to discuss the new second version of the Alternative Investment Fund Managers Directive, commonly referred to as AIFMD2. The regulation affects many aspects of how fund managers must operate in Europe. And as we head towards the implementation period, now is the time for GPs to be considering what adjustments they might need to make. Some of the key areas covered in the conversation include cross-border investing, limits on the use of leverage, and requirements relating to liquidity and risk management. To hear more of our episodes, head to privatedebtinvestor.com/podcast, or you can search and subscribe to the Private Debt Investor podcast wherever you like to listen. Well, thanks very much for joining us this morning, Yuri. And this is an opportunity to find out more about the Alternative Investment Fund Managers Directive, more to do with the second version, I guess. But perhaps you could start off just by framing this conversation by talking a little bit about the roots of this legislation, when the first version came in, some of the conclusions that were reached around the first version, things that perhaps were good about it, not so good, and why the second version has come along, and indeed, how long fund managers have to implement the recommendations arising from the second version.
So the AIFMD was born in the depth of the financial crisis. In the EU, there was a strong feeling that, although hedge funds and private equity and then private credit, which wasn't really there at the time, didn't directly cause the crisis. They might have contributed to certain things, and generally it was seen as an unregulated sector. And the G20 recommendations came out and said every part of the market, every financial instrument, everything under the sun now needs to be regulated. So proposal came out and pretty much introduced the same or similar disciplines that you saw in the UCITS world. So that was really one of the big problems initially with the proposal. This was about markets that are professional, markets that are not really constrained, but they were trying to put the UCITS framework into what was really a much more sophisticated and professional market. So after 2 years of very difficult negotiations, we ended up with a text that broadly worked and focused on the manager and the disciplines the manager has to introduce, as opposed to the fund and what the fund does in terms of strategy and composition of the portfolio. And that broad philosophy was important because it had to capture, again, everything under the sun other than your typical long-only bond and stock investments like you have in the UCITS world. So that flexibility around product design was ingrained. And unfortunately, and now we're coming to the current version, that philosophy is also becoming eroded. And the way that the policymakers have chosen to look at private credit in particular shows you a potential future where we're going to have much more of this product-focused regulation or strategy-focused regulation, as opposed to a principles-based rule system that is focusing on how the manager operates, as opposed to what strategy they may pick and how it might become constrained by the rules, right?
Yeah, and just in the interest of setting the scene in terms of the sort of timeframes that we're talking about with this second version, before we go on to talk about what some of the implications are, managers have a sort of 2 year period, isn't that right, to implement from this point?
Roughly speaking, yeah. Yes. There is an 18 month implementation period from the point at which the text gets published in the official journal. We know what the text is. It's already available. There's plenty of resources that people can find in either through our associations or otherwise. But the official journal publication is not there yet. We expect that sometimes March, April, and then add another 18 months plus another sort of 30, 60 days for that kind of period from when the text actually becomes active. So yeah, roughly speaking, early 2026 is the time that people have to think about starting or where the rubber hits the road and you have to start implementing actually much, much before that, right?
Okay, yeah, for sure. That's an important point, isn't it? That might be the final deadline, but of course, people have to be thinking about this now, really.
Just one thing to add, this is just a framework text. This is what we call level one. The devil's always in the detail, and there's a lot of implementation text that's still waiting to be published. So European Securities Markets Authority and the European Commission will be publishing detailed rules that will be, you know, probably finalized by the end of this year or early next year. And that's when you're going to see the full picture. And that's when you're going to have to start really thinking about implementation.
Yeah. And you referred to a conversation we'd had previously, and the interview that we did went into the February issue of Private Debt Investor. So people should check that out when they get the chance. But, you know, when we did that, we talked about, you know, potential risks to financial stability around private credit. And, you know, my sense from that conversation was that there might be some justification, but not necessarily that much. But what the regulators really had in mind was a possible point in time where private debt might become a more significant player, may account for significantly more assets under management. And I think you talked about putting in place guardrails to make sure that when it does become much larger, it is regulated in an appropriate way, I suppose. And that informs this as well, doesn't it? This really is a major reason why something like AIFMD comes into being. It's to do with ensuring that financial stability, or at least trying to.
Yeah, it is really, I would say, the second response, because already the first AIFMD was meant to be addressing systemic risk explicitly. That's why fund reporting to regulators was developed, so that they can actually track the increase, decrease, morphing of risk in the fund sector across different strategies. That's why the possibility of a leverage limit was introduced in Article 25 in the old AIFMD. And so that was quickly forgotten, because there's generally a big demand, especially in the central banking community, to really box in asset management more generally to make sure that financial stability concerns don't arise. That is at least the first kind of argument that you hear. There are other arguments, and we can get into that, but the financial stability argument is important, and it pushes the envelope when it comes to addressing what are considered to be the core issues when it comes to asset management. And that would be liquidity mismatches. So when you're, you know, giving investors daily liquidity, but you're buying illiquid assets, and what happens when the investors want their money back, addressing that, and then leverage, and, you know, how leverage can result in either endangering the counterparties who provide that leverage, primarily the banks, and destabilize markets by forcing fire sale of assets. So that financial stability narrative has just kind of continued unabated. And even though there were tools already in the first AIFMD, there was a heightened concern around private credit in particular, and then other asset management strategies. And so what is the AIFMD to do? One, for all asset managers, it really introduces these liquidity risk management tools and forces funds and managers to use those tools when either this is something that's to be done for the good of the investor, or where there might be, and that's the concern that central banks continue to have, wider stability concerns, but they're not as internalized by the managers, right? So ideally, the central banks would like the public authorities to be able to introduce some of these restrictions and not leave all the decision-making just to the individual asset manager and their judgment as to what's appropriate, what may or may not damage liquidity in the market, what may or may not introduce greater volatility, right? So this revision of the AIFMD deals with, one, again, the wider asset management world, and then it picks out one particular strategy called loan origination, so private credit, defines it within the directive, and then introduces additional tools and additional restrictions to those that are now introduced to the rest of the asset management world. And we can talk about that. But that's, again, a continuation of something that was there in terms of the restrictions already at the beginning in sort of small doses. It's becoming much more pronounced. And to depress the listeners further, whatever had been done and is being accomplished in the second review of the AIFMD is already deemed to be insufficient for macroprudential purposes by some of the policymakers in the EU. So we're likely to have this debate continue, and we can talk about later on what else could be considered on top of what's been introduced this time around.
Okay, thanks, Jerry. So, there are a number of sort of headline making, I suppose, implications arising from AIFMD2. And we'll come on to talk a little bit about loan origination funds and leverage, which are two of the things that you just mentioned there. One of the big talking points, I think, is around cross-border investments and funds' ability to invest across different markets in Europe. And this traditionally, loan origination activities across Europe have traditionally been difficult and I think legislated by the individual member states. I think AIFMD is an attempt to sort of move beyond that to enable cross-border investment. Is that right? What do you see? Firstly, is that right? And secondly, what do you see that happening in reality? Or do you think there are still challenges around that?
Yes, that's right. If you will, one of the positive things that might come out of this regulatory intervention. As the individual member states started to allow other non-bank actors to lend in their jurisdictions, they didn't have a pan-European regime to look at. And so what they used to do, the French or the Italians and the Germans, they would say, okay, well, we will craft our own non-bank lending regime. And because they can only control that which is within their jurisdiction, they would say, okay, here's how it looks like for funds. So the funds cannot use leverage, they cannot lend to retail, and so forth. They must diversify their portfolios. So each country, as we had a positive movement by getting rid of this bank monopoly on lending, at the same time introduced local restrictive rules, which then made it difficult to do this activity on a cross-border basis. What does that mean? Is to use a Luxembourgish fund for loans to French entities. You had to have a French entity, or similarly for Italy and stuff like that. So this positive movement towards more non-bank lending or fund lending created this fragmentation of the market, and the Commission, in its drive to further the single market, use this opportunity to say, yes, we will now get rid of, because we're going to harmonize what loan origination is and what the sort of risk parameters around it ought to be. That should give all countries comfort that it can be done safely from another jurisdiction, as long as that jurisdiction is within the EU. So this, what we would call cross-border lending passport, is there now. And, you know, some lawyers would say more or less strongly anchored. There are always attempts by member states to then kind of reintroduce various barriers and restrictions. So at the moment, we're not seeing that. But I always like to throw in a word of caution that we might still see friction operating, and we might still see differences. But by and large, yes, the Commission's behind it, member states and the Parliament are behind it, and we want to have a single market in this activity.
Sure. Okay. So some positive signs, as you said. One of the other interesting talking points is around loan origination funds, which you've already mentioned that term, and the significance of them for these purposes. So I think firstly, one of the interesting things is what a definition of a loan origination fund would be. Because I think that's significant, isn't it, in terms of the extent to which managers are actually affected by this legislation or not?
Yeah. And initially, the definition was such that if you had, as a fund, originated a single loan, you would be a loan origination fund, with all the attendant restrictions like leverage limits and liquidity risk management tools that were above and beyond that for other strategies. So we went to the Commission and the European policymakers. So this doesn't make sense. Because what you're going to do is you're going to put people off of, let's say, accidental or incidental or opportunistic type of strategies. Those pools of capital will not be participating in provision of capital, for example, in crisis times like we had during COVID. Many providers out there, they might not have been specialist loan origination funds. They will have started providing capital in this form. And if you create this kind of very conservative barrier between who is and who is not a loan origination fund, especially if being a loan origination fund is not very attractive, you're going to decrease the provision of capital to the real economy at times when it really matters. And we were listened to, and so the definition now really is about loan origination having to be your main strategy, and by main strategy, broadly speaking, 50% of your portfolio, if it's originated by you, as in the manager/fund, then you're meeting that definition. Loan origination itself is also an interesting concept in the directive. It's being defined, and one of the debates around that was, you know, the use of fronting banks, for example. So sometimes, you know, the fund itself might not be the direct original lender, but might be participating in a transaction affecting the terms of the transaction. So those kinds of things would be caught within loan origination. But then equally, what we tried to make sure was that the broadly syndicated market is not caught in this idea of origination, because again, it is a different beast, as we all know. And trying to do that in a single definition is tough. It's just one of those things, like you know what an elephant is once you see it, but defining it might not be that easy. So we think that there is a good balance struck there now, that the scope of application of the rules is going to be targeting the actual thing that the policymakers wanted to, whereas before it was definitely not the case. And you would have had, again, single loan funds being loan originating funds, broadly syndicated fund strategies being a part of the loan origination complex. And that would have been disastrous, we think.
Mm-hmm. On leverage limits, they've been brought in both for closed-ended and open-ended funds, but different levels applicable to each. So perhaps you could talk through that and maybe some of the issues there, including definition of leverage, how straightforward it is to apply these limits, etc.
Yeah, this was probably the most difficult discussion because it's technical and because, generally speaking, as I think it was Cliff Asness said, there's three dirty words in the world of finance. It's derivatives, leverage, and short selling. So here we're dealing with one of the dirty words, and there's a lot of fear and a lot of conservatism when it comes to the use of leverage by funds in a lot of jurisdictions, right? Especially now that the UK has exited the EU, the conversation tends to be a little less sophisticated. And so initially, the member states wanted there to be a 150% limit, which means really 0.5 debt to equity ratio. And that would have been for all types of funds. And we managed to convince people that that's really, again, bad idea. It doesn't allow the banks to participate in the funding of the economy in an indirect manner like they do today. And that generally speaking, the strategies are run at 1 to 1.5 to, you know, debt to equity ratio. And that doesn't appear to be an extremely high level of leverage, right? So over time, they've agreed and looked at the data we provided and said, okay, fine, we can differentiate at least between closed and open end funds. And for closed-end funds, we can go for a higher limit. So now it's 300% using the commitment methodology. It's a technical term, which means 2 to 1 in terms of debt to equity. And then 0.75 or 175% for open-end funds. Is this something we are happy with, or industry is happy with? Not necessarily so. Again, because open-end funds in today's world of private credit, they're not your daily dealing, you know, usage funds. They behave a lot like closed-end funds in terms of restrictions on liquidity. And so we don't think that sort of much lower limit is actually warranted. But again, that was like the best thing we could get out of that situation, and feel that, again, at least on the closed-end side, we're not really talking about constraining, you know, 100% of the industry. There's some strategies that might be constrained by the 2-to-1 limit, but they're not your vanilla direct lending strategies that we see elsewhere. And so, again, we hope there's not going to be much damage done. And it creates that guardrail that you mentioned, that you know, if people want to, you know, increase leverage to 5 to 10 times equity, I guess that's not going to be available in the AIFMD world.
Yeah. And yeah, you mentioned it there. There is this caution, isn't there, around liquidity risk management when it comes to open-ended funds, you know, but that's probably only going to apply to a relatively limited proportion of the universe, right? Even though perhaps open-ended funds are growing in appeal to some people, but still the vast majority of loan origination funds you'd expect to be of a closed-ended nature.
Mm. True, that's what we see today. But what we also see, as you pointed out, a growing popularity of some form of an open-end structure, a hybrid, semi-liquid, evergreen, pick your word, for a number of reasons, but primarily in the institutional space for reasons of efficiency of deployment of capital, where investors just want to have a permanent allocation with a manager and don't want to go through the cycle of asset raising and then liquidation of the funds. And again, we don't see that as being your true kind of open-end bond fund-like structure that would possibly present some of the liquidity risks that the policymakers are worried about. But again, we had to actually fight for the AIFMD allowing loan origination funds being open-end, right? Because the initial proposal was to say, no, if you're doing loan origination, you all have to be closed-end. So a lot of discussion around the need, or why would one need open-end funds, and then the ensuing additional liquidity risk management tools that were put on these open-end funds. So open-end loan origination funds will have, you know, yet another layer of liquidity tool and other liquidity restrictions put on them, precisely because, again, people felt that that was the sort of the price to pay to allow them to be open-end.
And I understand there's also issues around retention here as well. So, yes. And I'm imagining this could present some practical issues. So this is a requirement on the sale of loans that some part of that loan is retained, which presumably could cause issues for some people. Could you explain what that really means and what people could find themselves up against?
Sure. Another one of those ghosts of the GFC rearing its head, as the listeners might recall, securitization was the heart of the crisis last time around. And one of the remedies going forward with securitization was to say, hey, we need skin in the game of some sort. This originate to distribute model where nobody has an incentive to do correct underwriting and look at the risk because you're offloading it as soon as you can, resulted in this retention requirement being introduced all around the world, one way or another. And here, again, one of the key risk elements that people thought about was you know, sound underwriting. What if all of a sudden you decide just to ditch your underwriting disciplines for whatever reason and try to offload the risk to unsuspecting parties in the market and then sort of infect, if you will, the rest of the market with really bad paper? Anybody who knows private credit and direct lending understands that all the incentives are aligned in the opposite manner, right? It's an illiquid product, so good luck trying to sell it, because the whole idea is to create something which is bespoke. That's why the borrowers like it. Second of all, your investors are looking at you very carefully and trying to make sure that your underwriting disciplines are up to par. And then if you are getting the financing from the banks to lever it up, of course, the banks will look at all of the collateral that they are financing. And so you get like at least like 3-4 pairs of eyes plus inherent illiquidity due to the bespoke nature of the product. They really make it so that it would be hard to develop an originate to distribute model in this space. Nonetheless, again, in that kind of what if the meteorite hits the earth scenario, what do we do? People felt that the 5% retention requirement was going to be the one thing that ensures that, you know, managers and funds and investors eat their own cooking and they can't, you know, sell down all the loans unless there's some sort of particular circumstances that allow you to do that. So you will have to keep 5% of the notional of the loan that you originate or the fund originates. And so the fund will have to retain that. And it is, unlike in the securitization regulation, not necessarily clear, and it's going to be one of the discussions that we'll have in the ensuing months and or years. So what does that mean? What, you know, can we look at the 5% in a different way than just 5% of the notional? Because, for example, if there's two loans and one is senior, one is junior, if I retain the junior loan, can I just get rid of the senior if it's a single transaction, same borrower? Because that kind of mimics the types of retention that are available under securitization regulation. So you can have like a horizontal slice of a securitization or a vertical slice of a securitization, whereas here it just says, no, you have to retain 5% of the loan. So we'll have to clarify whether other flexibilities exist so that people can, again, do this in a more flexible and efficient manner while sort of meeting the objectives of the regulation.
Sure. Okay. I mean, with a lot of this, you can sort of see the good intentions underlying a lot of it. I think you'd question the applicability of some of this. there's another area worth talking about, I think, which is, I suppose, what they have in mind here, the regulators, is the need to diversify and try and ensure that not too much risk is kind of held within the system, for want of a better phrase. And this is, I think, limits on the extent to which you can sell to financial entities, be they banks or other funds. So you can see the reasoning behind it. But again, presumably here, this could create difficulties for people.
Yeah, it depends, again, how the world develops. So the general legislation tells you to have a, you know, 20% maximum exposure to a single financial institution. Again, on the face of it, okay, maybe not so problematic, but then you think about the world, let's say, of microfinance, where you might be financing a single entity with a loan that then provides micro loans to, you know, borrowers in the developing world. Very common model. And so that kind of diversification requirement might hamper what you do, and you might need to sort of structure things differently, again, for reasons that are difficult to understand. Similarly, if there's going to be more fund finance developing, again, if a fund lends to another fund where previously it would have been a bank, and we see that already with, you know, NAV lending strategies, again, you're providing a single loan to a single financial services entity. And so, you know, how does that diversification work? Can you look through to the underlying assets to say, well, there is actually underlying diversification here, and so let's count that towards this kind of 20% limit? Again, things that we'll have to work on clarifying with the competent authorities and hopefully work on making a bit more flexible. Again, you know, not necessarily in the core of what happens in private credit, but in these kind of edge cases and markets where you might want to have further flexibility also from a public policy perspective.
Okay. Well, that's been fascinating. Thank you very much, Yuri, for talking us through the background to the directive, the latest developments, and a little peek into what the future might hold. Thank you very much.
That again was Yuri Kroll, Global Head of the Alternative Credit Council within the Alternative Investment Management Association. For more episodes, head to privatedebtinvestor.com/podcast or search and subscribe to the Private Debt Investor podcast wherever you like to listen. I'm Andy Thompson with PDI. Thanks for listening.